One of the unfinished journeys that I thought about was kind of caused by an invitation to give a keynote speech at a major solid-state circuits conference. Traditionally, there's a conference called ISSCC, International Solid-State Circuits Conference, that's held annually. And almost everyone involved in the semiconductor industry goes to this conference. And their view was they wanted to hear someone from an application perspective of how, what kind of needs are likely to be there in the future. And so I predicted or projected, based on the Moore's Law and other information that we had, that we will have chips with a billion transistors within, 10 years or so from that time, or less. The talk was in 1985, February 13th, I think it was. And and I also said, already given the intensity of the human effort involved in designing these chips, we'll need to go to larger conceptual blocks of designs. And as the case is turning out to be, these days, in these multi-core chips, you can have complete processors or complete subsystems on a single chip, and then you interface it with the rest of the components, subcomponents of the total chip design. And this seemed like something that had to be done in order to hide the complexity and get the human effort under control. Otherwise, the entire population of the world will be designing chips for a small number of people that might use them. So the talk called Super Chips and Artificial Intelligence was kind of an interesting challenge for many of them, and I believe that many of them afterwards said they heard what I said, but they didn't believe that I needed all that computation. But as we have since come to see, any image processing or conferencing application or image compression and transmission applications, we use up a huge number of cycles and sometimes require special purpose processing elements. The next unfinished journey I'd like to talk about is what we call parts on demand. After we started the Robotics Institute in 1981, Paul Wright and Fritz Prinz joined from the Mechanical Engineering Department into the Robotics Institute, and they were active faculty members of the Robotics Institute. And the idea was, if right now, if you wanted to make a mechanical part, it's a major undertaking. First, you have to produce a drawing, and then you have to take it into a machine shop, and then you would do the machining, and there would have to be somebody there. And they, assuming that they have all the right parts and right tools, they could perhaps do it over a period of days. And the machine tool maker has to figure out how he was going to produce the part of the dimensions from the drawings, because that process of going from art to part, as they used to call it, is all done dynamically and is never written down anywhere. So the question was, if there was any way we could systematize that whole process, that is, given a desired shape of a part, that is to be produced ultimately from a block of metal, what are the steps? What tools are needed? What processes are conducted on the, using the tools? And how is the cutting done? In what order? All of those things have to be derived automatically if you're going to produce a part on demand. Namely, if I could draft or design a drawing with the usual drawing of a machine part, and then instead of sending it to a machine shop operator, tool operator, who then figures out how to do it. The idea is, can you actually derive the steps automatically of what it would take to go from a block to a machine part? And that turned out to be a very challenging, difficult problem, and Paul Wright started working on it while he was still here, and then he went off to Courant Institute at NYU, and from there he went to Berkeley, and I'm happy to say over the next 15 years he continued working on this problem and produced finally a working system. At various times in between, he would say, yes, I can do this, and I would send him a design part, and then it would kind of get, the process would break down because the steps were not all completely automatic, and people would have to be involved. And if people are involved, then it depends on the vagaries of their availability and whether they understand what is to be done. And so significant delays were introduced whenever there were people in the process. And I believe finally he has been able to generate a system that would produce parts on demand. And there's a recent paper he sent me a copy of, in which I am also a co-author, because I assume because I was the one that suggested the problem and have been after Paul to continuously to make sure that the problem is actually solved. So that is the third unfinished journey. I guess it's getting finished, but it's another approach to this problem was done by Fritz Prinz, who is also a professor in the mechanical engineering department here, who has since left and joined Stanford University as a chaired professor. And the main area of his research was, rather than machining, which is removing of metal from a part, can you deposit metal, a molecule at a time perhaps, so that you can produce the desired shape by synthesis rather than by accretion of material. And this idea was enabled by the invention of a technology called stereolithography, where a particular plastic shape would solidify when exposed to light. And that whole technology was used to produce 3D models from from computer descriptions. So the most dramatic one of that kind was, we had President Richard Syed come and sit in front of multiple cameras. Professor Katsu Ikouchi, who has since gone to University of Tokyo as a professor, would produce a 3D description of the entire face of the bust of Dick Syed. And then we used the stereolithography technology of in the Fritz Prinz's lab to produce a 3D statue of Dick Syed. So the idea of going from a multiple image view of an individual and then producing a 3D description, which is fine enough to be able to use for producing a statue, turned out to be a difficult challenge. First of all, at that time, this was, I guess, in 1988 to 91 or so, getting a 3D description of an arbitrary shape like face of a person was extremely hard. And one way that was done was by what is called structured light. You know, you'd project a grid of light onto the object or a person, as the case may be, and based on how the grid appears in the two cameras, you're able to compute what each of the grid intersection points, the distances are, to millimeter accuracy. Ultimately, you need to go to micrometer accuracy, but we were not there at that point. With millimeter accuracy, you can produce the things. Unfortunately, the technique fell apart when it came to modeling of the hair. The hair would stick out, and there'd be one strand sticking out. And modeling that, in a way, turned out, you know, so that it can be used in a 3D projection, a 3D statue creation, turned out to be very difficult and error-prone. So what we did was, what Katsu did, was to smooth the such image and remove thin strands of solid, which would have been difficult to produce anyway, from the model, so that what we ended up with was something that's reproducible as a 3D solid. And that turned out to be a very interesting set of technical challenges. And so both these methods, one is by accretion or synthesis, and the other one by material removal, are both have been tried and can be used to produce a part on demand from description. And the main thing about the 3D statue is the description is also automatically generated from multiple viewpoints using structured lighting. And since then, Carlo Tomasi and Takeo Kanadi have been able to invent more sophisticated modeling techniques, which are able to be used on a complex 3D surfaces to determine the range information from multiple viewpoints. So that that continues to be an interesting, challenging problem, and one of the unfinished journeys. Except I expect I am not going to be doing the unfinished journey myself. So the next one is application-specific architectures. It turns out most of the problems we were working on, both in speech and vision, required a huge amount of computation. In the 70s and 80s, and even in the early 90s, the computers were not fast enough to be able to do the computation in real time. And so if you wanted to recognize an utterance, and you didn't want it to take minutes or hours before you got an answer, and if you wanted instantaneous recognition and response from the computer, then one had to explore other alternatives. One is to use parallel processing of general purpose computational units. And the second is what is called application-specific architectures. It turns out there is a case that can be made for both of these solutions. The general purpose solution makes it easy for an individual to put together multiple parallel systems and have them solve the problem. But the algorithm design would have to adapt to the parallel execution streams, and not all algorithms are easily mappable into that type of parallel execution. And so even though you may have 100 processors, you may only get a speed up of 3 or 4 or 10, especially if the computation involved a lot of memory accesses or pointer chasing, as we used to call it. And this particular nature of the computation led Roberto Bisiani and Harsh Mauersberg, working with me, to develop an application-specific architecture for speech recognition, where they analyzed the algorithm and found that certain amount of parallelism can be gotten provided the execution is tailored to specific microcode that is more application specific. And this means you're kind of programming at not assembly language level, but one level below that in microcode level. And that can be very time consuming and not something you want to undertake. However, if you have a tight inner loop of a few instructions, a few tens of instructions, then you can afford to take the time to write that code in of the inner loop in microcode, and the rest of it, which is only occasionally executed, less frequently executed, can be done in a higher level language. In any case, Bisiani and Ravi Mosher built a Sphinx architecture, which was able to be demonstrated for real-time speaker-independent recognition. And what we found, of course, is the speed-up came in two parts. About roughly a factor of 10 came from the architecture, and another factor of 8 or so came from algorithm improvements, and that is rearranging the computation so as to minimize the number of memory accesses. And this kind of type of algorithm inversion techniques are kind of necessary for speech and vision, so that you're only touching each element of the signal only once and do all the computation that needs to be done, so that you don't have to make multiple accesses to the same data. And so that turned out to be a very interesting approach. An earlier version of the same thing called Harpy Machine was built, and that was the paper was about that was published in the IEEE journal on computers. Finally, the last unfinished journey was not so much technical but administrative. Around 2001 or so, one or two, CMU decided to establish a West Coast campus, and Jim Morris and Duane Adams were the principal champions of the idea. And I was also in strong support. But they tried to get the program started and going, and had difficulty because there was nobody with responsibility and authority to make things happen. So I had just stepped down as the dean of School of Computer Science. They asked if I would go there for a few years to ensure that the program was launched, which I did, and after 3 years, you know, I kind of handed it off to Jim Morris because I was not the champion of the project. I was not as much of a champion as Jim. So the situation there is, after the bubble burst in the Silicon Valley, the funding that was promised beforehand never did materialize, and which in turn meant that we could not expand the scope and size of the thing as much as we had hoped to. And that experiment is still in progress, and we are hopeful that unfinished journey will kind of conclude successfully at some point in the future. So that concludes my discussion of unfinished journeys. Thank you.